Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and we have a very special guest. I have Richard Shook with me. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Donald. Good to be with you and your listeners.
Richard is the professor of drama at Queen's University in Belfast, and he's here because he has a wonderful book, which I just finished reading this past week, called How Sondheim Can Change Your Life, which will be published on November 19th, just in a couple of days, on Atria Books, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster. And as you can tell, it's a Sondheim book. It is about Sondheim musicals, but it's a very different kind of Sondheim book. And I have to tell you, it caught me by surprise. I didn't know what to expect when I read the book, which we will get into as we delve into it. I will have to tell you, I mean, I read it, I downloaded it onto my tablet, so I was able to take it with me throughout my day. Sometimes I was reading at home, sometimes I was reading in my car as I was having a coffee. As you will hear, there were a couple of times where I was a little emotionally overwhelmed by some of these chapters, which turned into some rather, I don't want to say embarrassing experiences, but some difficult experiences for me. But because it touched on a lot of things that I've dealt with myself. But before we get to the book and how, and I think it's an important book. I really do. I congratulate you on that, because this is not your typical musical theater or history book. It really isn't. And I think that's why this is an important book for the listeners to pick up. So congratulations on that. So before we get started, tell the listeners a little bit about your background, where you grew up, how you got interested in musical theater and in theater in general, and how you ended up where you are now, which is at Queen's University.
Thanks, Donald. Yes, I'm at Queen's University Belfast in Northern Ireland, but you can tell from my accent that I am not from Northern Ireland. I'm an American, born and raised in the U.S. I grew up in a small town outside of Philadelphia called Kennett Square, one square mile, literally, you know, I think three traffic lights, three churches, one square mile. But Kennett Square is where I got my first taste experience of the theater. I got bit by the theater bug, but I should probably say performance, not theater, because my little town is the mushroom capital of the world. And when I was young, back in the 70s, we had a Miss Mushroom pageant, which now sounds very camp and hysterical. It was probably camp and hysterical back then. But one year, I remember, my mother was doing the costumes and my father was helping with the lights. And they let me, I must have been 7 or 8, and they let me sit in the audience and watch the dress rehearsal. And I remember the finalists from the Miss Mushroom pageant wearing ball gowns and sitting on these gigantic stuffed mushroom toadstools. And I was just captivated by the glamour and the aliveness and the vivacity of performance. Well, I think performance is the word, not theater or drama. And I was like, I don't really know what this is, but I know that I'm drawn to it like a moth to a flame. So that's my unusual engagement with performance, and my love for performance has never left me. And my first memory of Sondheim, I was 9 years old, and it was the Tony Awards, and it was Follies, and I remember the music from Follies and the Tony Awards, but I didn't really know what the Tony Awards was. I didn't know what Broadway was, but I knew the music touched me, was speaking to me in a way that I couldn't fully understand, but I knew there was a connection emotionally between me and the music. And my first sort of more mature understanding of Sondheim was when I was 17 and the cast album came out for Sweeney Todd, which that I then saw the following year in my freshman year at Georgetown when Angela Lansbury and George Hearn were doing the first national tour. And when your first live Sondheim is cannibalism and serial murder, you are hooked for life. So I think all those kind of experiences basically gave me a love for the theater. So, and I was a bookish kid as well. So it was kind of inevitable that I ended up as a theater academic. I did my graduate work at Stanford in California, but ever since graduating from there, I've been over in the in the UK. For a long time in London, I helped to create a drama program at the University of London. And for the past decade now at Queen's in Belfast. But I've taken with me from America my love for the glory, and I'll admit it, the emotional power of the great Broadway musical, exemplified no better than in the works of Stephen Sondheim.
And so talk about how did this book come about? I mean, there's been a lot of Sondheim books written. So finding a unique approach to discussing Sondheim musicals, how did this concept come up, and what inspired you to write it and write it this way?
You know, I've been teaching Sondheim's works to undergraduates for years, but it really wasn't until his death in November 2021, so about, you know, three years ago, almost to the day, that really got me thinking. Those kind of events will sort of move you to reflect. And I began to think, well, you know, it's not just the works, it's not just the music or the lyrics, it's what they mean personally, emotionally, how we absorb that material, not just how we observe it, but how that material starts to live in us. And I thought, you know, that's the story that has to be told, not the critic's appraisal, because I'm not a musicologist, not the critic's appraisal of the works, but a very personal, sustained reflection on how these works touch us to our core, and if we let them, can shape how we live, can illuminate the crises, the hopes, the fears, the love, the tragedies, and the triumphs that we all have in life, just as sometimes characters do. So it's how the works, as Dot says in Sunday in the Park with George, how Sondheim's works give us more to see, but they give us more to see about our own lives. So that's the kind of book that I've written, a personal reflection that I hope is an invitation to the reader to also have a deeply personal, indeed emotional, reflection on the works. It's not a biography. There is a great biography, and there's a wonderful biography by David Benedict that's going to come out soon. It's not a musicological study. It's not an academic book by any means. And it's not a coffee table book filled with a lot of Sondheim anecdotes either. It's a kind of excavation of what the works can mean to us individually, psychologically, and emotionally, which is why I was so glad, I have to say, to hear you say that it was overwhelming at times for you to read the book, because I have to admit to you and your listeners that it was overwhelming at times to write it. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with, say, a little night music whose theme is regret. And, you know, in the weeks I was working on that chapter, it was like living inside the bubble of regret. Which was, you know, takes its emotional toll. But it seems to me this is the payoff of the works, that it's reaching a depth, right, inside us. So in a way, you have responded, though it may have felt painful at the moment.
Well,
you've responded how I hope readers will respond.
Well, right. And to be honest with you, I purposely didn't read up on, I mean, I knew that you were teaching drama at in Belfast, but I didn't read up on your biography. I wanted to kind of go in as clean as possible. But as I was reading it, I was like, does he also have a degree in psychology? Does he also have, well, because you really delve into kind of the psychological underpinnings of the characters and the stories that are being told. And I love how you interject a lot of personal anecdotes about your own life,
yeah,
into each chapter, because let me kind of explain to the readers. It's the book covers 11 Sondheim musicals in chronological order. In addition to like Anyone Can Whistle is sort of like in the intro, not included in the 11, but Anyone Can Whistle sort of in the introduction. And then Here We Are is sort of in the section you call exit music at the end. But the 11 are from Gypsy to Passion. And each chapter is then kind of subtitled how to something. And they are sort of like, I don't want to call them life lessons, but they're sort of instructional things that you get out of each show. And you kind of take us on this journey that's sort of, I want to call them, it's your own personal journey, even though you do insert personal experiences yourself. But, and you do give some historical information about the shows and behind the scenes things that were going on with the shows. But the most important thing you get out of reading each chapter is this experience of what is going on with the message of each show, about what you can learn about and take away as an audience member from each show. And that's one of the things I felt was so intrigued. It was almost a cathartic experience reading the book. It really was. And I got so much out of it that I didn't expect to get out of it, because and the funny part was, I said to a friend of mine, who's also a theater person, who I said, you have got to read this book. As I said, you know what, when you read a theater history book, whether it's a book of a biography of a composer or a specific kind of shows, your urge at the end is to go back and listen to the cast recordings or something mm-hmm. like that. This made me want to see the shows again. And that's a rarity. You know, I wanted to go back and see a production of the shows, or go back and watch the videos of these specific shows, because I kind of wanted to experience again some of the stuff that you point out in these shows, that's kind of embedded in there that you may have felt but didn't realize was there when you were feeling it. So kind of explain what that process was like with each chapter, because each chapter is very different and there's something different that you get. And it's just amazing to me that that each show is so different, with a different lesson to learn.
Which is, of course, a tribute to Sondheim's genius, that not just are the shows different in form and musical style, they're different in the emotional or psychological subject that they present. But I have to say, it was so lovely what you said about the book, and thank you. And you used a phrase that I've used myself, life lessons from Sondheim. That's kind of my wonderful editor, Peter Borland at Atria Books, that's a sort of shorthand we developed about how to talk about the book, because it is a very short but precise way of understanding that each show offers a different lesson or perspective on life as we live it, whether it's about jealousy or fear of intimacy or revenge, whatever, or injustice, like it's in Sweeney Todd, whatever it might be. So the approach I took, and I have to say, I went round and round on the structure. And first I thought, well, maybe it should be thematic. And I had this very overly complicated arrangement of chapters and lots of cross-references between the shows. And then I thought, well, this is not going to be fun for the reader. And if the book isn't working for the reader, well, then there's no point in writing it. And I finally decided the best way was one musical per chapter, more or less chronologically from Gypsy through Here We Are. And that, because the chapters aren't that long, they're about 17, 18 pages. So you can dip in, mm-hmm. you know, read one chapter to go, start with your favorite show, start with the show you don't know at all, maybe Pacific Overtures, then move on to another one. But the book is anchored with what is the key insight or life lesson that Sondheim seems to be offering to us in each show. And once I got clear in my head what that was, then it was just a matter of unpacking that, elaborating on it, weaving in my own personal response to the material, as you've kindly pointed out, some backstage anecdotes, but not for the purpose of anecdotes, for the purpose of illuminating the substance of the show. And I loved quoting from Sondheim himself. I mean, all Sondheim fans will know his two anthologies, Finishing the Hat and Look, I Made a Hat, where, you know, the master himself speaks about his songs. And it was lovely to be able to quote judiciously from Sondheim himself to really sort of pinpoint, I think, what each particular musical is offering us.
Right. And I do recommend, and I'm one of those people who when I really love a book, I generally, you know, the common refrain is it's so good I couldn't put it down. I recommend the opposite with this book. I recommend you read one chapter a day at most, because I think it's really important to absorb and reflect on each chapter. Because I found myself reading one chapter a night, because the message and information in each chapter will hit you differently and has a lot to take in. And not that I think it's depressing or sad or anything. It's just there's a lot of stuff to absorb and it makes you think. And I think it benefited me more to read one chapter a night. And then the next night I would read the next one. And it is one that you don't have to read in order. You can skip around. I read them in order, but you can skip around because each one is very unique. And I would warn people, as I discovered, some of the chapters you may want to not read in a public place. You may want to read them at home because they can get a little emotional. For me, one of them, I unfortunately did read in a public place and it was not a good thing.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it didn't. It hit hard. And so you have to read one at a time. And for me, it worked better that way because it helped me absorb them better. So, and I also want to point out, even though you said you took a lot of quotes from Sondheim, I want to credit you because your writing is so good in this. Your writing is so good in this that there were, especially in one of the chapters, there were things that you wrote in there that I, because of some of the things that have been going on with me and someone that I'm involved with, there were issues in there that I literally lifted a section that you wrote and sent that to the person and sent that to the, because what you said had so much impact on me and dealt with, I knew was going to impact this person as well. And it did. Because what you were saying was so true and such an important life lesson instruction. And that was you. It wasn't Sondheim quote. It was a quote from you. And I said that. I said, the author put this at towards the end of the chapter. And I said, this is so, it deals with what's in this chapter. And it's so true. And this is something to keep in mind. So kudos to you on that.
Well, that's so kind and generous of you to say. It really warms my heart, and it makes me feel that writing the book, which was emotionally torturous in its own way, was worthwhile, because every author wants to, you know, to mix metaphors here, leap over the footlights and greet the audience, greet the reader. Every author wants to have a relationship with the reader, and of course, you almost never have the chance to know how it's happening, but in conversations like this we can find out. And thank you so much for being a receptive and generous and empathic reader, which is the kind of reader I was imagining. I was not just a Sondheim fan, but someone who would be as emotionally open and vulnerable as the works themselves,
right?
Kind of heart speaks to heart, really.
Yes, yes.
In these works. So thank you for that. And I'm going to tell the publisher, on the paperback version, we have to put the health warning, read one chapter at a time for safety reasons.
Yes. And certain chapters should not be read in public. that was very difficult. Anyway, I thought we would, I thought we would delve into three of the chapters / shows to give the listeners kind of an idea of what we're talking about. Yeah. And I think we'll begin with the first one, which is Gypsy, which is subtitled How to Be Who You Are. So talk about what the Gypsy chapter is all about.
Well, I suppose I should just start parenthetically by, this is the one chapter that includes a musical that involves somebody other than Stephen Sondheim.
Right.
That is, in terms of music and lyrics, because the composer for Gypsy is Julie Stein, and Sondheim did the lyrics. But it was not the last show. Do I Hear a Waltz? It was the last show for which he was just the lyricist. So Sondheim did the lyrics, Julie Stein did the music, and you know, everybody knows Gypsy. Audra McDonald is opening in Gypsy, I think, this week at the Majestic.
Start, yeah, previews start pretty soon, yeah.
Yeah, sometime in November. So it's a show that everybody knows. And of course, rightly, all the attention goes to Madame Rose, the towering, iconic figure. And although I hardly ignore Madame Rose, I decided to sort of go a little bit against the grain and focus on the title character, Gypsy, Louise, who becomes Gypsy Rose Lee. Because one way to look at the musical of Gypsy is Louise, who is long prevented from being who she is. She is told she is untalented. She is told she is ugly compared to her sister, Dainty June, the star of the act. She is forced to be the forever boy, the newsboy, the tin soldier, the farm boy in the act. Dainty June and her Toreadorables or whatever they are. And, you know, and at one point she plays the rear end of a cow. So she is forced into being everybody but who she really is. And this is so damaging to her psychologically, as it would be to anyone, you know, who feels the burden. As I say in the book, the greatest burden, I'm quoting the psychologist Carl Jung, it's not my idea, the greatest burden a parent can place on a child is the unlived life of the parent. As we know, Mama Rose puts the burden of having to be a star onto June and then onto Louise. And this burden is intolerable. But even worse, it prevents both June and Louise from being who they really are. June flees, but Louise is stuck. And she sings this beautiful song called Little Lamb on her birthday. And it's a really, your listeners will remember that scene in Gypsy. It's after Have an Egg Roll, Mr. Goldstone. The lights go down and they come up and Louise is sitting on a mattress with the lamb that she's been given as her birthday present. But it's not a genuine gift. It's a prop for June's act. And then she has a stuffed bear and then sort of drawings of other animals, a goldfish, a hen, a cat. And she sort of arranges these animals, real illusory, around her and sings what I think is the only love song in Gypsy, Little Lamb. And the painful poignancy of this song is that the love is directed to these animals, to these inanimate objects. And you know, it really wasn't until I saw one of my own students around Louise's age, not much more, perform this song that I really understood the depth of it, which is that Louise is giving to these animals the love, the care, the nurture that her own mother refuses to give to her. And that is how she is coping in a way. With, I don't want to get too make Gypsy feel like a tragedy, but in a way it is. It's an emotional tragedy for Louise. So she is forced to compensate for the love she is not getting in her own life by showing love to these animals that are around her. But also, this is the song that tells us that Louise is going to survive. She's going to triumph. She is going to become who she truly is. Why? Because she is capable of love. And we see all sorts of people in Gypsy who are not really capable of love. But Louise is. And you know, there's this wonderful moment where Jerome Robbins, the original director, was going to cut Little Lamb. And they cut it from one performance, one preview. And Julie Stein marched backstage. And he said, either you put Little Lamb back in or I will withdraw every other song in the show. So the next night, of course, Little Lamb went back in. And for me, it's one of the most powerful songs in the show, often ignored, but I think it's emotionally powerful. It shows us what Louise needs, what she's not getting, and what she has to provide for herself. And if there's no Little Lamb, there's no Gypsy Rose Lee.
Right. And it's also this one of the things you kind of pull back the curtain on, no pun intended, but with Gypsy is there's no sentimentality in the show.
None.
There's none. And I also like the fact that you kind of point out at the beginning of the chapter, you talk about the fact that every a lot of the songs are all about moving and getting things and wanting things. And yet dramatically, none of those things ever happen. Everyone's trapped and everybody's frozen in time because nobody ever gets anything they want. Nobody ever goes anywhere. Nobody ever really gets anything. They just don't. And it's everybody's ultimately trapped, including Louise. She's trapped in being this thing that her mother wants her to be. She's trapped as being this little girl who's not herself.
Absolutely. And, you know, it takes, you know, the three strippers in Wichita to release her from prison, so to speak. You know, your point about sentimentality is very well taken. And it just occurred to me as you were saying that, you know, there is some sentimentality in Gypsy, but it's in Baby June's act. It is fake sentimentality. So whatever sentimentality is in Gypsy is a fraud. Mm-hmm. And whatever truth, emotional truth is in Gypsy, is to be found in Gypsy, is actually pretty tough to take. It is pretty dark. And I love the lyric in Rose's song, you'll never get away from me, you know, which is one of those lyrics that sounds charming and endearing right up until the moment where you realize is actually very sinister. You'll never get away from me.
Right.
Rose, the monstrous mother who will never leave her children alone, which is why June runs away. And finally, Louise has to be reborn, but reborn as the person she was always meant to be. So Louise finally is the one person who does manage to get away and, in a sense, find herself. Whereas the other characters really, not even June, the other characters really don't.
Little bear, you sit on my right, right there. Little hen, what game should we play and when? Little cat.
Yeah, I found that the whole chapter really interesting because it kind of gives you a completely different perspective on the show. And you also, as you talk about, and as the whole concept of the book is that it really is talking to us about being ourselves and being who we're really meant to be. And you do talk about, you go into depth about the whole concept of stop trying to be completing someone else's life and being forced and being more focused on being in control of your own life and being who you're supposed to be and not being what other people want you to be. And you talk about parents pushing onto their children their unmet needs are being forced onto their kids.
You know, and I feel like I'm a living cliche. You know, I was the, 10-year-old nerdy gay child who liked to sing show tunes and read books, but whose father wanted him to be a great athlete, and that was just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But I really felt the burden of that, to sort of conform to somebody else's idea of the kind of person I should grow up to be. And the other side of that was the devaluing of who I thought I really was. So the story of Louise really, really hit home for me. And in a way, it was, I have to say, kind of therapeutic for me to write about that story.
So let's move on to Pacific Overtures, mm-hmm. Which is subtitled How to Be Part of the Whole. And a lot of this particular chapter focuses on one specific song, which is Someone in a Tree, because it really does drive the point home that I think you're trying to make, which is the whole concept that we as people were just kind of the whole word fragments becomes a big part of the concept of this chapter. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm so glad that we are talking about Pacific Overtures, because it's one of Sondheim's lesser-known works. But one of his most beautiful was first performed in 1976, of course, America's bicentennial year, which is a deliberately ironic year in which to do this show, because it's about Commodore Perry's invasion, essentially, of Japan in 1853, in which Japan was forced to sign a trade treaty, and the serenity of the floating island kingdom, as it's called in the show, was shattered forever. And the narrative high point of the show, which actually occurs only about halfway through, is the scene of the treaty signing between the shogun and Commodore Perry. And it happens inside a treaty house. The Japanese really did build a treaty house so that this moment was not witnessed. It could be a secret moment. And in a sense, and in the context of the show, if it happens behind closed doors and nobody sees it, we can pretend that the Americans never came here and never forced us to sign a treaty. That's the conceit of that moment. So treaty house is built on stage, but there's a tree next to the treaty house, and a little boy climbs to the top of the tree because he wants us to find out what's going on. And he can see through the eaves of between the slats. He can see into the treaty house a bit, but he cannot hear what is going on. And underneath the floorboards of the treaty house, there's a samurai warrior with his weapons ready, who is instructed, if things go awry, to burst up through the floorboards and attack the Americans if need be. And he can hear, but he cannot see. So these two characters, the boy in the tree who can see but cannot hear, and then the warrior below who can hear but cannot see, are Sondheim's and librettist John Wideman's images for the way we all experience life, which is we experience only the partiality of life, the fragment of life, the bit of life. We can only know so much about what is happening. The totality of events and the world is always eluding us a little bit. Now, this sounds like a very abstract academic concept for a song, and Sondheim was very aware of this, and he really didn't want to write a song for this scene because he was afraid it was going to, which is essentially about history, how to understand your place in history, that history is much bigger than you are. The song says you're just a fragment of the day and the part that's underneath. And Sondheim thought, well, how do I write a song? You know, nothing's happening here. How do I write a song about nothing? And then he realized that a song about nothing could actually be a song about everything. which is why the melody, it's 304 bars, I think, to this song. Bum, 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 bum. And that's the vamp you hear hundreds and hundreds of times in the song. And I think what's wonderful about this song as a song is that Sondheim has somehow captured the flow of time, the relentless flow of time, the arrow that keeps moving forward, that is time, that is history, that is life, that is experience, or as he called it, everything. And all we can do is have our own little part of that. So the music is giving you the endless flow of time in which we are all absorbed. But the lyrics are doing something different. They're giving us very specific images. It's the building, it's not the beam. It's the ripple, not the sea. I'm trying to remember the exact lyrics. But the lyrics are all about the part that stands for the whole, that we are just a part of the event. We are the pebble. We are the one beam in the building. We're the stone, like in a Japanese stone garden. We're the stone, not the garden as a whole. But there is a beauty in that, and the music is bringing up this beauty. And the lesson of this song, though it can feel a bit elusive, a bit theoretical, is that whenever you feel that you're missing out on something, you're not seeing something. You know, we say FOMO, fear of missing out. This might be the original FOMO song. Mm-hmm. I think Sondheim's lesson here says, of course you're missing out. Of course there's something bigger than yourself. Of course there's always going to be more that you cannot see or experience or have. And that is the nature of reality. So why fight it? Rejoice in what you can do, what you can have, what you can see, the beam, the pebble, the stone. And that is the way, I think Sondheim is saying, to be in the world, be at peace with encountering the world in whatever way you can, and stop fighting or wishing or wanting that you could somehow do all the things that aren't really possible. And I think this is why Sondheim always cried when he played or heard other people play someone in a tree, because it is so overwhelming in the way that it unburdens us from worrying that our life is not rich enough or full enough or complete enough or filled with stuff enough. The music is inviting us to relax and stop fighting all the things we think that are wrong with our life. Mm-hmm. And in fact, embrace and exult in life as we live it. And I think this is why Sondheim was so overwhelmed by this song. It was the one song he always said was his favorite, that he couldn't bear to play it in rehearsal in front of the whole Pacific Overtures company, because he knew he would be overwhelmed. He would find it too emotionally. You were talking about being in a public place, reading the book. He would find it too emotionally overwhelming. So he said, I'm going to play it just for John Wideman, the librettist. And he did. It was just the two of them in the rehearsal room. And he sat down at the piano, and before his fingers hit the keys, he started to cry because the song was so deeply powerful. And I have to say, I saw Pacific Overtures at the Meunier Chocolate Factory in January. And of course, I was weeping throughout Someone in a Tree. It's an emotionally powerful song. And if you don't know Pacific Overtures, it is one of the lesser known works. I highly recommend to your listeners that they give themselves the pleasure of encountering the song Someone in a Tree.
Pardon me, I was there.
You were where?
At the treaty house.
At the treaty
there
house.
Was a tree.
Which was where?
Very near.
Over here.
Maybe over there, but there were trees then everywhere. May I show you, there if were you trees please. Then everywhere.
But you were there.
And I was there. Let me show you.
If you please.
I was younger then. I was good at climbing trees. I was younger then. I saw everything. I was hidden all the time. It was easier to climb. I was younger then. I saw everything. Where they came and where they went, I was part of the event. I was someone in the tree. I was younger then.
Tell him what I see.
I am in a tree, I am 10. I am in a tree.
I was younger then.
In between the eaves I can see. Tell me what I see. I was only 10.
I see men and matting. Some are old, some chatting.
If it happened, I was there. I saw everything. I was someone in the tree.
Tell him what I see.
Some of them have gold on their coats.
One of them has gold. He was younger then.
Someone crawls around passing notes.
Someone very old.
He was only 10.
And there's someone in a tree.
For the day is incomplete
without someone in a tree. Nothing happened here.
I am hiding in a tree.
I'm a fragment of the day.
If I were used to say, things would happen in the way that they happened here. I was there. In a tree.
Pardon me, I am here, if you please, I am also
they
here.
They kept drinking cups of tea.
They kept sitting on the floor.
They drank many cups of tea. No, we told him that before.
If you please, I am here.
You are where?
In the treaty house.
The treaty
or very near.
Can you hear?
I'm below.
So I
underneath the floor, and so I can't see anything. I can hear them, but I can't see anything.
But you can hear.
But I can hear. Shall I listen?
If you please.
I can hear them now. I shall try to shift my knees. I can hear them now. I hear everything. I'm the part that's underneath. With my sword inside my sheath, I can hear them now. One is over me. If they knock, then I appear. I'm a part of what I hear. I'm the fragment underneath. I can hear them now.
Tell us what you hear.
First I hear a creak and a thump. Now I hear a clink. Then they talk a bit. Many times they shout when they speak. Other times they think or they argue it. I hear floor. I hear them, they are there. As they argue it, I'm the listener underneath.
Someone reads a list from a box.
Someone talks of laws. Then they fan a bit.
Someone bangs a fist.
Someone knocks. Now there was a pause. Then they argue it. But we won. No, you can't, and we won't. But we need it, and we won. Will you grant? If you don't, we concede it.
I may sat the night. They lit yellow tapers.
I was there.
I totally agree with you. I think Pacific Overtures is, I don't want to call it underrated, because I think people who know it love it and they understand it. And I think the chapter is so insightful about, because and the song, of course, is the perfect tool to use to get across the concept of it's really about enjoying what you have in life. And stop feeling as though you need to be part of a bigger thing. We're all part of this whole thing as we are, and you need to enjoy the small part you inhabit, and enjoy what's around you, and enjoy the people in your life, and enjoy the things you have, and enjoy the good things you have.
You put it better than I have, because there is nothing else. The things you don't have, you don't have.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
So it is fruitless to dwell on that. And it can sound sort of almost greeting card trite, certainly the way I express it. But with someone as, you know, masterful as Sondheim in the music and lyrics, it's a more profound and eloquent experience to hear this song performed. And you're right. It's not the Pacific Overtures is underrated, it's that it's underknown.
Yes.
Yeah. It's underexperienced.
So now we're going to move on to Passion, which is the last, kind of the last full chapter. I mean, you touch on Here We Are very, very briefly at the end, but Passion is the last one you do touch on, and it is about how to love. This is the chapter that I highly recommend you do not read in a public place, which I read in a public place, which was a big mistake because I ended up sobbing in a public coffee place, which was... I'm not going to call it embarrassing, because I'm the kind of person who I'm not afraid to express my emotions. And if people, I don't find it embarrassing to express my emotions, it can just be a little awkward, let me put it that way. And it tends to be a little awkward for the people around me. But it was a very emotional experience to read this chapter, only because it hit a lot of, buttons for me over recent experiences and some current experiences that I'm dealing with. But it really was very insightful. I mean, having seen the show, the original Broadway production during previews, I understood the tinkering that they had to do with the Fosca character because there was a lot of problems during previews because the Fosca character is so difficult to deal with in this show, to get the balance right. She's not a sympathetic character. She's not a character that the audience is going to love, but she's delivering the message, and she's also delivering the message to Giorgio, the male lead, and she is the conveyor of the life lesson in the chapter. And it's really about being worthy of love, And that's what she's suffering from. She's not medically ill. She's not physically ill. She just is unworthy of love, and she's never experienced love. And so talk about passion and the show and the message, because it's really powerful. The writing in this chapter is so powerful, and the message is really important. Important enough that I cut and pasted part of your chapter and sent it to somebody.
Well, Donald, thank you for that. That's so lovely to hear. And you have the gift of tears, which is beautiful. And to allow yourself, it was 94, I think, right? So
yeah,
to allow yourself all these years later to connect at such a deep level with the material. What a wonderful moment to have. Mm-hmm. And this is why we go to the theater and why we revisit the theater in our minds, why we replay the song so that they can continue to be relevant and meaningful and powerful to us. And it was, I have to say, I was a bit weepy as I was writing this chapter. And that's not me in my writing. It's the weight of Sondheim's material. Because who thought that you could have a Tony Award-winning Broadway musical that is basically about feeling that you are beyond love's reach, that you are unworthy of love. As Fosca says, she is not someone to be loved. And she's not, as you say, she's not physically ill. She is emotionally ill because the world, her family, her associates have told her and continue to tell her that she is defective to her core. Of course, and I was especially thinking about growing up as a young closeted gay man. And that's just one instance of how people can be told that there's something wrong with them. Right. But that was the one that was powerful for me as I was growing up. And all readers, all listeners, will have their own biographies that they bring to the material. And you're right that we don't like Fosca. But we are not meant to. This is really not a show. And this is one reason why passion divides audiences. Some people, it was one of Barbara Cook's famous shows, favorite Sondheim shows. But some people just have never warmed up to this show. They just don't like passion. They recoil from Fosca. And they just don't want to see it again. But I think it's deeply moving because it denies us the usual access that musical theater has, which is likable, lovable characters, musical numbers that we can applaud, or sometimes trademark, clever wordplay and ironic lyrics that we can congratulate ourselves for understanding. It takes all of that off the table and essentially gives us raw, bloody, painful emotions, and then dares us to look at them. In her first song, I read, Fosca says, look at me, no captain, look at me. And that's a kind of motif for the whole show. You have to really look inside yourself if you are going to solve whatever ails you. And that seems to me what's happening in Passion, that Fosca has to look inside herself to discover that she really is someone to be loved. She has to be able to tell herself the story that is the opposite of the story the world is telling her every single day of her life. The world is telling her she's a witch. She's ugly. She's defective. She's flawed. She's an outcast. She doesn't belong. So she cannot find solace in the world. She tries with Giorgio, but it doesn't work. How could it work? Because Fosca hasn't looked inside herself to find what is beautiful uh-huh. about herself. But she does find it. And the turning point song is Loving You, which she sings in the train scene in the second act. She appears like a stalker. Giorgio is is on the train. He's very ill and he's going back to Milan, back to his lover, his married lover, Clara. And just as the train is leaving the station, Fosca appears with her suitcase in his train carriage. And you think, will this woman never leave him alone? He is besieged, hounded to the point of death by Fosca. And here she is, ready to harangue him once more and force her love, her desperate, crazy love upon him. So we are expecting another firework moment, because we've had these moments from Fosca earlier in their show. We're expecting another devious, menacing moment, like when she forces him to write a love letter to her. I wish I could forget you. And then Sondheim gives us something entirely different. A short song, a quiet song, a measured song, a pure song, in which Fosca speaks her love. Loving you is not a choice, it's who I am. So this is the song, and when we see that Fosca has looked into herself, and she realizes she can love, and that Giorgio is the object of her love, and in a way, she has no choice but to love Giorgio. The love is so strong. But because she has confronted the truth, accepted the truth within herself, she doesn't need to be crazy. She doesn't need to scream and shout. She doesn't need to be crafty and menacing. She is quiet. She is serene. All her physical symptoms are in retreat. Why? Because she has understood the truth about herself. And this song has an extraordinary effect. As short as it is, it completely changes the way Giorgio looks at Fosca.
Fosca, you have to face the truth. Please. You have to give me up.
Loving you is not a choice. It's who I am. Loving you is not a choice, and not much reason to rejoice, but it gives me purpose, gives me voice to say to the world, this is why I live. You are why I live. Loving you is why I do the things I do. Loving you is not in my control, but loving you, I have a goal for what's left of my life. I will live and I would die for you.
And here we have to credit James Lapine for the libretto, because after the song, Lapine wrote for Fosca to say to Giorgio, in the end, you will see what is beautiful about me. And Giorgio does. They go to bed at the end. She dies right after, but he does love her by the end of the show. And he does see what is beautiful in her. But Giorgio can love Fosca only because Fosca can love herself first. And that, and I'm getting a little, I have to say, I'm getting a little choked up just remembering the song. It's so powerful. That is the beauty and the poignancy of loving you. And in typical Sondheim fashion, he wrote it very, very late in rehearsals. But it is exactly what the show needed at that point, because the whole show turns in that one short song.
And that's really the important thing about the whole chapter. It's really all about... And one of the things you said is that the show is so divisive because people are kind of repelled by Voska. And you quote, in the chapter, I think you quote, I think it's one of the critics who wrote about the show or a theater writer who wrote about the show, who said a lot of people kind of want to look away from Voska. But the real reason they want to look away from Voska is because they see themselves. They see themselves. And that's true. I think that's the problem, is a lot of people see Voska, and I think a lot of people have seen themselves as unworthy of love at some point in their life. And they see too much of themselves in Voska, and they don't want to see themselves, and they want to look away. And I think that's one of the problems that people have with the show, is it's, and you, I think you bring this up in the chapter also, is that the show is so nakedly honest with its emotions about all three of the main characters. I mean, Giorgio, Clara, and Voska are all very exposed. Clara and Giorgio at the very beginning of the show are literally naked on stage. Yeah. But it's very nakedly honest about all three of these characters on stage. I mean, Clara is in it for what she's in. She's married. She has this lover, and she's in it for the physical love. And when she realizes what she's dealing with, she ultimately tosses him aside. But she's very honest about things. Nobody's a villain. Everybody's very honest and open about what they want. And Giorgio ultimately learns what love really is and what love is really all about from Voska. It really opens his eyes.
Exactly. And as he sings, you know, love, you know, what is it? Love within reason. Love within reason. That isn't love. That's Sondheim's lyric. So there's something excessive and unreasonable and unbounded and absolute about love. You cannot love by half measures. That's Clara. Love by half measures is not love. Mm-hmm. And as you rightly say, Giorgio, it takes Voska, as wild and intense as she is, it takes Voska for Giorgio to grow up in love and to become a man who can love. He was just pretending. He was a toy boy lover with Clara. He didn't realize that. She did. But he becomes a man in love only because of Voska.
And then at the end, you pose some pretty difficult questions for the reader at the end of the chapter about the risks you're willing to take and how far you're willing to put yourself out there to really discover who you really are and to find that you are really worthy of love. Because Voska goes to extremes. I mean, she manipulates things, and she's very melodramatic, and she does all these crazy things, as you say, to try and win Giorgio over. And ultimately, she gets there, and she gets to find her loving herself through the process. And you pose that question at the end of the chapter, which is, how far are we willing to go to embarrass ourselves or to like risk throwing, you know, risk putting ourselves in uncomfortable positions in order to prove to ourselves that we can be loved and to see our own beauty, which is, you know, something else you talk about.
Yeah. And of course, this is the question that Sondheim and Lapine pose through the show. It's a question that emerges through the performance. And Voska, in her pursuit of Giorgio, is willing to shed all dignity. She's willing to stop worrying about making a fine impression. And this, to me, the lesson is not that we should act like Voska. God, no. But there is something in her behavior that we should pay attention to. That there has to be a sacrifice of ego and a willingness to be vulnerable and a willingness to not care too much about how we are coming across, whether we are making a nice impression. And if we can let go of all those trappings of our idea of, you know, what a nice bourgeois life should be, then maybe we can be honest about how we feel and honest with someone else. Otherwise, we're just play acting through social appearances. But it takes the melodrama of Fosca, the grotesqueness of Fosca, to make the point that we really have to stop pretending about our emotions, because that is the safe, easy, comfortable way. And as Giorgio sings at the end, love is not safe or easy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I am sure you are thrilled with the feedback that you've been getting on the book. I've been reading people's comments online, people who've gotten advanced copies.
It's been gratifying that that readers are connecting with the material, meaning, of course, Sondheim's own works in the way that I hope they would. And that's so reassuring and a wonderful experience for any author. And I'm glad that, to use an appropriate metaphor, that the material has struck a chord with readers. And one of the loveliest things I've been hearing is people saying, I have to stop reading every 5 minutes and go to Spotify and play the song.
Right.
And then I get back, and then you were talking about you want to go see the whole show. But I would encourage readers, you know, when a song comes up in a chapter, either it's a song that you know very, very well, or maybe a song you don't know very well, put the book down, go and listen to the song, and the book will always be there when you want to return to it.
So the book, as I said, will be out on November 19th, just a couple of days from now. And where should people go to find the book? Would you?
There are lots of ways. I'm a big champion of everybody's local independent bookstore. So I always encourage that. And there are more traditional ways, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And if you go to Simon & Schuster website, you can order directly from the publisher. So all kinds of ways for readers to get the book.
And do you have a website? I can't remember.
I do not, but I am on Instagram, SE1_Richard. That's my zip code in London, SE1_Richard. And at Twitter, or X, I am PR, as in public relations, although that's not what it means. I'm PR Shakes, SHAKES, which is weird, but that's me. Twitter, PR Shakes, Instagram, SE1Richard. Please check out posts. I have posts about the book, about Sondheim, and please feel free to follow me. I'd love to connect with you and hear from you.
Yes, I will put your Instagram up as a link on the radio show page, as well as I'll put Simon & Schuster up as a link also, so people can get right to Simon & Schuster to find the book. I highly recommend it. It's so wonderful to read. I absolutely loved it. If you take my recommendation and do one chapter at a time, just because there's so much to absorb from what you're reading. It just, for me, it worked better to do that. So do you have a favorite Sondheim show or a favorite Sondheim song yourself?
That's such a good question. And the beauty of Sondheim is whatever you're feeling, whatever you're going through, whatever troubling you, or whatever's making you feel joyful, there's a Sondheim song to fit your mood. So I guess my favorite songs change, but I guess I have to say, you know, Sweeney Todd, Angela, my first Sondheim, you know, nobody forgets their first love. And so Sweeney Todd is going to be the one for me till the day I die, which is appropriate for Sweeney Todd.
Right, exactly. And are you contemplating another book? Or are you working on another book at all yet? Or are you just savoring this one right now?
I'm definitely savoring this one. And I'm looking forward to meeting in person or virtually as many readers as I can, because I really want to know what people think of the book, good, bad, or indifferent.
Well, Richard, thank you for taking the time to chat about this book. It is called How Sondheim Can Change Your Life. I will definitely say that this book changed mine after reading it. It really did. So I commend you on that. I loved it. I loved every page. It was just amazing to read. So congratulations.
Thank you. And
thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Donald, it was great chatting with you. And I want to thank your listeners for tuning in. Here's to more Sondheim in all of our lives.